Hey folks, welcome to Typology, the show in which we explore the mystery of the human personality through the lens of the Enneagram. My name is Anthony Skinner, producer of the show. I hope you're having a fantastic week. And for those of you that are getting prepared to celebrate Labor Day weekend, I hope you're heading somewhere where there is lots of sun. I know that I am. Hey, we have a really great show for you today. A super guest. I'm talking about licensed therapist, writer, and recovering idealist, featured in the Huffington Post, Health Central, Catalyst, and Fathom magazine, author of the brand new book, This Too Shall Last, KJ Ramsey. Today we talk about suffering and faith and how sorrow and joy can coexist. This is such a powerful concept that we really need to understand because we really do live our lives in the tension between sorrow and joy. So I know you're going to love this episode. Hang on to your hats, people. That's it for me, Anthony Skinner. And now without any further ado, here is the host of our show, Ian Crum.
KJ Ramsey, welcome to Typology.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah, we're delighted. You have this this wonderful book, This Too Shall Last. I love the title. As a 4 on the Enneagram, it seems to resonate with me. I don't even know. We're going to have to go into what it's all about, but already I'm hooked by the title. Tell everybody just a little bit about who you are and the background to this book.
Yeah, so I am a recovering idealist. I'm kind of haunted by my own massive dreams for how life is supposed to be and what it actually is. Mm-hmm. I am a big nerd. I love to read. And so I basically have found myself in a profession where I get to be really nerdy for a living and write books, but also get to spend half of my week working with clients as a therapist. And I focus a lot on complex trauma, but also religious trauma and some medical illnesses, because I live with a severe autoimmune disease. And that's a lot of the story that's involved in This Too Shall Last, is my story of getting sick when I was 20 and a junior in college, and it never went away. Wow. And just like facing, this is part of my life. And really, like, I had buried hard things and suffering, and it was just like a little go-getter until that point. My body just forced me to reckon with that I have feelings and that I can't just push through everything. So This Too Shall Last is a really personal journey through learning that you don't have to pray away your pain in order to be faithful, and that God is in the midst of it. And in my belief of Jesus made flesh, this man of sorrows, there's a sacred presence in our suffering. And so I get into nervous system stuff, the way that we're created for communion, and the way that there's a unique way that pain kind of can propel us into intimacy with God and with ourselves and others, if we're willing to stop trying to push it away so aggressively.
Right. You know, ones like Marie Kondo write books about tidying things up.
Yeah.
And threes like Mike Hyatt write books about productivity.
Right.
Eights like Anthony Robbins writes books about, I don't know, walking on coals and, you know, fire and shit like that. And fours write books about finding redemption in pain.
Yeah, that's right.
It's like as cliche as it comes. Like, I was thinking about this yesterday and thinking about our conversation. It's like, you know, it's kind of, it is, it felt actually for me, because I wrote this after I had known my type and was doing a lot of work of integration. And I remember thinking, like, it's kind of courageous for me to put this out there, because there's the risk of becoming a cliche. There's the risk of being seen like I have glorified my suffering, or I'm just like stewing in it, or, you know, it's so it was kind of my little, but I'm going to do it anyway. Like, but you know, this is what I have to share.
You know, I don't know if it's cliche. I think, you know, we've had Andrew Peterson on, and Andrew is a quintessential four. And you listen to that music, and it is all about trying to find beauty and redemption in suffering.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think all of us have been assigned errands.
That's right.
You know?
Yes.
And, you know, different people are gifted at making sense of different life experience. And I think for fours, this just happens to be one of their superpowers. That's all.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's that's how I see it. And I feel like it's a sacred gift to get to usher people, like invite people to sit down in this place that you don't have to be afraid.
Mm-hmm. Right.
There's goodness here.
Yeah. And the other thing is that fours, I just did a 2-day workshop this week, and, you know, with a bunch of executives, 60, 70 executives. There was not one four in the room. It was the only number not. Oh, well, wow. No, one person in the room realized
they were a four.
They were a four.
Wow.
They thought they had been something else. Then they realized they were a four. And then they really were the odd man out in the room. Wow. But,
and then they're like, I need to make a life change.
Yeah. And I went out and I bought them a copy of Let Your Life Speak. And now they're done for. They're definitely going to get a new job. But, you know, I think that's kind of our gift, you know.
Yeah.
It is also, as because you're a therapist, a great job for a four, is being able to step into those thin places, those sort of darker spaces where we're comfortable with emotions that other people aren't. And then we're able to be guides them, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, I was laughing at this thing. I was like, you know, when I'm a priest on the side, you know, so it's, I said, you know what? I'm great at funerals. And I am. I hate doing weddings. Sevens like doing weddings. I can't stand them.
Right.
To me, I'm just a piece of furniture en route to a reception. Oh, right. You know what I mean?
That's funny. Yeah.
But at a funeral?
Yeah. Mm. My husband is a pastor and working as a chaplain right now because part of our story. But he got to do his first funeral last fall. And it was just like a tiny group because it was still the height of COVID. Although. Mm. We're back there. But I got to just like stand in the back and watch him make space for this grieving family. And I saw even like a woman, one of the grandkids of the person who died. He on the side is a hospice chaplain, Ryan, his husband. And this grandkid was holding up the phone because one of the other grandkids couldn't come because she had COVID. She couldn't travel to it. And it was just this really beautiful way to dignify this man's life and bless this family and like let them walk into the next season honoring what had happened. It was really cool. It's special when, like, I don't know, I've always probably been fascinated by funerals, let's be honest, I am a four. But like it was really special to get to watch my husband occupy that space and like expand the space for everybody else to be there and have it be meaningful.
Yeah. Yeah. I just think it's a thing.
It was really beautiful.
It's a thing and not everybody can do it. And, it comes with its own burdens and blessings, you know? And, so that's just, you know, how it goes. Now in the beginning, you are a four, you were mistyped for a while, right?
I was, yes.
So, tell, please tell.
Oh my word. Okay. So when your first book came out and you had the Road Back to You podcast, first of all, my husband and I were like the first people out of our community who were getting into the Enneagram and this like spiritual formation thing we were in for a couple of years, uses it heavily. So we were like working on typing ourselves. We didn't have anybody to compare ourselves to, like, oh, this person is kind of like this, or they hold their body differently than I do, and all these things. So we typed me as a one, and I But I always felt like I didn't feel nailed. Like it was like, this is too generous to me because I've grown so much in this area of my like guilt and anger, my self-criticism. Like surely I should be a little more nailed than this. And also my husband kept going with it like, this is, you just don't want to be your type. And that's why you feel this way. You're just like rejecting yourself and all these things. So anyway, I was listening to one of your like first interviews. I don't know if it was on Typology or The Road Back to You, but you interviewed two ones at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And I kid you not, I almost, I was sitting there listening to it. I was like, these people aren't like me at all. They're getting it all wrong. They don't know themselves. So I almost got on your Facebook page to be like, I don't think this is what it means to be a one. And then I didn't do it because I was like, if he ever saw this, he's going to think, of course you're a one, you're being critical. And so I did it. And then lo and behold, I was the one who was mistaken. So
funny.
I feel like I have to confess that. But it was actually that also with the experience of my husband not getting it, just like I felt missed. Mm. And so staying with that feeling that he didn't get me, that he was, there was something about my experience of myself that was unknown to him, made me get in touch with how that's how I felt my whole life.
Mm.
And there was this deep grief of my childhood, and the way, like a lot of it was buried because I was just like very just head in books and like doing my thing. So I didn't grieve as I went as a kid. But just, I grew up in a really chaotic home. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the feeling of being misunderstood by my husband, first by you though.
That's great.
I love
really
that.
Got me in touch with that I'm actually a four. And then it took a while to like discern my dominant wing, and the subtype took even longer. And I just took my time. But I think the process was just, it was very painful and it was very good. And I felt like, this is kind of terrible to say it this way, but I'm going to say it anyway. I felt like I was coming out of the closet. Like when I finally owned this is my type, it was like there was this buried weirdo inside of me that I always kept hidden, and I wasn't allowed to show anyone because I would be too judged. And it was like the creative part of me just started to bloom. And that's when I was really starting to publish things and like move toward writing the book. So that's the story.
Wow.
Love that.
I do love that. And I love that you're modeling something for our Typology family, which is that, you know, one of the beautiful things about the Enneagram is it helps us to discover essential self, you know, and make room for it. And so, like, you know, we have this oft repeated phrase, which is, you know, the Enneagram doesn't put you in a box. It tells you about the box you're in and how to get out of it. And sometimes it's because the box we're in is wrong. You know what I mean? Like, I'm in the wrong box. And when you find out your type, you're not jumping into another box.
That's right.
No.
You know, it's not like you jumped out of the one box and got into the four box. It's like, get you out of the four box.
I had been living in that box my whole life. Even though we mistyped me as a one, it was what I, in like, you would have been able to see it because you sit with people every day, but it on the externals, like, it probably did look like I wasn't one.
Why do you think that?
Because, or one, there's some probably three energy there too, but
are you a self-pres four?
I am.
Okay,
yeah, and
it took
a really long time to figure that out.
It does.
So, and then it made more sense of like why we mistyped me for so long. But it was like my family system. I think this is a big part of it that I've been curious about. Maybe this would be something interesting to talk about. I'm sure you guys have talked about it on here before, but like the impact of our family system on what role we think we're supposed to play, but also trauma and just like what we do to survive, what we do to feel safe. And for what I did to feel safe was I became exceptional. Like mm-hmm. I became exceptionally diligent mm-hmm. and I constantly had my nose in a book and just like lived here and like I was exceptionally good. And but there was this like buried sorrow under there. So I might have looked like my parents call me, have always called me this. I hate it. Sorry, parents. They've always called me their little sunshine. They almost named mm-hmm. me this. Thank God they didn't. Because I'm not a sunshine. But like this role that I'm supposed to be the sunshine because some other people in my family who shall remain nameless, like mm-hmm. made it dark. And I took on that role. And so my view of myself was so shaped by those heavy expectations. And that was my only way for so long to belong in my family.
Right.
A family that I never felt like I did fit into, but it was one way I could, was to be like good and happy.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So.
And that you say this all the time, this self-pressed four is called the Sunny Four.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're called the Sunny Fours. They're the counter type. So what's interesting, I think I was, you know, often wondered if I was a one early on, right? And I think part of it is because both types tend to be perfectionistic mm-hmm. and dissatisfied with the way things are. Mm-hmm. And that's right. Like, we confuse the disappointment with life that fours have with dissatisfaction that the one has.
Yeah.
With life, right? And mm-hmm. and so they can kind of be a little bit of a lookalike because disappointment and dissatisfaction can kind of look the same.
Yeah, they're that like what is that, the Hornetian triangle, like 1-4-7 that like we are all idealists in our own special way.
Yeah, ones and fours for sure are idealists, and you know, and sevens in a different way, you know.
I was never thinking I was a seven. I'm not fun enough.
I did.
I know you did. I've heard you say that.
Yeah, I did for sure.
I was just like, oh, I'm the person who like does not want to go to a party and just But I'm also highly sensitive, so that's probably part of it there. But
yeah. Well, and the other thing is that when flooded with feelings, a one would become more concerned with their duties and responsibilities than with the feelings.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That is not my problem.
Yeah.
You know,
that was what did it for my husband. That was when he finally, because it took him a long time to come around to being like, you're right, which makes him sound terrible, but it was real. And he finally realized that like that emotions first stance of like, oh, when we have a fight on the way to the grocery store or church or something, I need to finish the fight before I go inside.
Right.
Or I will do it inside.
Right, right, right. Because the like, feeling, you're all in the feelings.
Yeah, like mm-hmm. I've got to rectify the tornado happening mm-hmm. before I can do things. So mm-hmm. that was really what helped my husband see, oh, a one wouldn't, they would be able to set that aside and like go do the next thing.
Well, go do the right thing.
Yeah, you really struggle with
that's
that.
Right.
Yeah, they would need to say, okay, well, we now need to put this aside because we have a duty
right.
or a responsibility that's to right. do the next right thing.
Yeah.
And the four wouldn't definitely not approach it from that angle.
No.
Now, your husband is a nine.
Mm-hmm.
You're a four. I don't know about you. I'm married to a nine. I'm a four. So we could have a long conversation about that.
Yes.
But so tell me what it did to your marriage when you figured out your type, your husband was on board, and like, what did it change the way that you relate to each other, your dynamic? What happened?
Yeah. So we were often embattled before we learned our types. really feeling like the other person needs to change. Like, it's mm-hmm. that classic, like, we're just working our asses off to change each other. And not really seeing things from the other person's point of view, but like, you know, him seeing my emotional outburst or whatever, and being like, that is wrong. Like, you need to chill. We got some terrible advice when we were in premarital counseling from a dear man who's a great friend. This was the worst advice we could ever receive, especially for a 4 with complex trauma who didn't know it at the time. He said, when KJ's goes into this shame spiral and she's in the pit of shame and she's like self-flagellating, you need to don't go in with her. And she needs to, Yeah, it's bad. Find her way out herself. So we did that for at least a year in our marriage. We've been married 11 years now. And Kelly, I'm like, every single time that would happen, I felt like I was going to die. Now I know a lot more about the nervous system, and I was in full out dorsal vagal shutdown, freeze, like collapse zone. And when you're down there, you need co-regulation in order to rise back to your embodied, wise, grounded self. And so the beautiful thing about the Enneagram, like learning our types, was on my end, he learned how to come toward me and that I actually needed his presence, and that wasn't a bad thing. It was a holy and beautiful thing. Mm-hmm. And on my end, I got to see like his anger and his stubbornness. It gave me this like a peace that he's not gonna choose to stay stuck. He's owning where he is stuck right now, and he's not gonna stay there anymore. I was really like the gentle nagger before. It just gave us this acceptance of our fundamental differences, and we became more gentle and patient and kind and also playful with each other. Like, of course, we had to learn that way to like not weaponize our types with each other, but mostly we learned how to just laugh. Like, one of my favorite things I say to my clients sometimes is like, look at you being you. Mm-hmm. Just like, look at you being you. It's just, we're just so ourselves, and now we don't have to be so like, we can receive that, like have a posture of receptivity to each other instead of always reacting against it out of this anxiety of we're not good or we're stuck because of what's happening. So it changed so much.
That's wonderful.
Beautiful, yeah.
Isn't that a nice little testimony there?
Yeah, love that.
Let's close in prayer. Pass the collection plate. Close in prayer. Maybe you got a nice hymn out there.
Yeah. I have to ask this because it was significant for me as a 4. Did you ever confuse your idealism with perfectionism?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, I definitely did. And it's frustrating now more so. This too cliche again, but like when other people do that, they don't see that just this like deep, almost sometimes pathological drive to do things really well and to be competent. Like, yeah. So, like, for example, the prayer book that I'm writing, like I would have never let myself write this, prayers and poems, because to myself, like, I have to master a subject, like study it for a long time before I can feel like I'm allowed to show up. But social media, like, oddly gave me this space to play with poetry, and I didn't know that I was playing with poetry. So I would like write little lines and play with line breaks. And then I realized, oh, that's a poem. And it's moving for people, and you can keep doing this, and you don't have to have read every like well-known poet of our time to keep writing.
Right.
That's how my perfectionism like comes out. It's more like just my ideal like exceptionalism, really fixated on competence.
Mm-hmm. Are you a 5 wing?
Yeah.
I am, and it took, again, this time my husband came in clutch. He was. was the one that like helped me see that I've like, I just was so uncomfortable with my intelligence and my brain as a female. It felt like I always had to kind of hide the way that I just love to learn. It felt like you're not supposed to be this way, so like keep it hidden. So it took me a while to own the five part, but oh, it's more about for me the my energy conservation than even competence.
It's wild because I was thinking the same thing when you asked that, because the way she just described her experience sounds very five, and you even have like a five energy, you know, mm-hmm. even as you're mm-hmm. communicating, you feel five-ish, you know, mm-hmm. yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it took you a while. I don't know. I feel grateful that I could give it space to mm-hmm. not be like, I have to define myself, which mm-hmm. is my major wing. And it made it kind of more beautiful then when I started to try on that maybe I do have a five wing. And it just came at the right time. My therapist at the time had helped me see that I'm a highly sensitive person. And it was like, I needed, it's kind of like, I was this onion and I needed to, the outside layers needed some like very tender peeling, like, because there was goodness there and we didn't want to rip it. And I needed to go slowly.
Mm-hmm.
And learning about my sensitivity and this like innate difference about how my nervous system is wired discharged and disarmed the shame about mm-hmm. my own tendency to shut down and be overwhelmed and like need like a lot of time away from people. And that almost that like primed the pump, if you will, for me to then like, okay, this is good. Like how I am is good. And my constant, like, basically examination of my energy and my time and, nothing will send me down the autonomic ladder faster than, like, seeing my calendar and being like, we have to add one more fucking thing. It makes me feel like I'm going to die. Like, I can feel great when I'm with people, like this is great, but I will be really tired afterwards. Like
mm-hmm.
it's, and clients are a little different. Therapy, I feel like I've learned how to kind of like absorb less, maybe in a good way. But anyway, I'm going off on tangents. It's been a process.
Yeah. Yeah. Let's talk about suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let's.
Right. I mean, we got three people in the room. We're going to know how to talk about stuff. Let's finally talk about something we know about, Anthony.
Finally,
we get to talk about something we know about,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So this book, This Too Shall Last, really is a book about suffering. And I would love it if you could give me, and I'm going to put you on the spot here, sort of a two or three sentence observation you have about human suffering. What have you come to learn about human suffering? Two or three sentences, please. Go.
We are allergic to grief.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I could even just let it sit there. I realized in my own experience of pain and loss that most people are naturally allergic to grief and pain and push it away with all their might. But when we learn to occupy that space,
mm-hmm.
be present in that space, there it's almost like it. Earlier, you said the word thin space. It's like space becomes thin. And we get to perceive and participate in another dimension of goodness
mm-hmm.
than we generally are capable of participating in when we're so hurried and we're striving mm-hmm. so much.
Mm-hmm.
That's where I went today. If any day you could ask me this question, I might say it a little bit differently, but there's profound potential in the space of human suffering
mm-hmm.
is something I've learned.
Right. So I had a, and I've told this story before, and so for those of you who've heard it, too bad. But I had a spiritual director. He's an Episcopal monk. His name is Brother Curtis. He's at the Society of St. John the Evangelist in Cambridge. And one day he got really angry at me because I was bitching about my childhood and my life and everything that, you know, I find wrong with myself, because nobody can do self-loathing like a four, right?
Yeah.
So I, neuroticism, I score high on the, what's called the neuroticism scale.
Too.
You know what I mean? It's like, wow, you really do bad feelings a lot. Anyway.
Yeah. You're excellent at that.
Yeah. There's me being me. He said to me once, he just got fed up with me, and he said, you know, Ian, this is your life. These are the cards. What's the invitation? And I remember, well, first of all, my head exploded when he said it.
Yeah.
And then the what's the invitation piece doesn't sound very obvious, but he was like, you know, embedded inside of the story of suffering, there is always an invitation.
Always.
And to discover the invitation is kind of the point, you know? But you
can't say yes to
just
your
life. to say yes to your life. And you know, so many people spend so much energy, as I have. Like, I can't tell you how many decades I spent fighting with my childhood.
Yeah,
I just fought with it.
Yeah,
and it a lot of times just unconsciously, like, I refuse to have had this childhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
I refuse it. And I am going to fight it. And I'm going to have an argument with God and my childhood for the rest of my damn life. Mm-hmm. And you know what? You never win that argument.
No.
Ever. You will. It's like it causes so much damage to your own soul to be in that fight. Mm-hmm. And so I've just never forgot. It's like, hey, dude, these are the cards. Maybe the staircase you've been given in life is steeper to climb than some other people who had more charmed childhoods. Well, too bad. That's how it is. Now, what's the invitation? To what are you being called to do with that experience?
Yeah.
Because guess what? It ain't being anything else but what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. And the sooner you accept it, not resign to it, but accept it, then maybe God can do something with you.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is that, I don't know, does that?
Yeah, that resonates so much. And I think in the religious communities I've been a part of historically, or was, especially when I first got sick, so almost 13 years ago. So there's been a lot of life that's been lived since then, and a lot of change in what I believe. But there's this fixation. I think people sometimes don't even go there. Because there's a scrupulosity, really, like fixation on being good and being like, even I poke fun at this phrase in the book because it's just gross to me, but like making beauty from ashes, like, yes, it's scriptural. I get that. But why do we feel like we have to turn our like storm clouds into sparkles? I don't get it. And that's what we've made spirituality into. And so what I realized was in the space where my body stopped me, like I went from normal/maybe a little too busy, 20-year-old junior in college, to I couldn't hold a pen. And I needed help to walk to the bathroom. And that persisted. And like, I still have many seasons where I am in pain every day. I've never had a day without pain in 13 years. I have seasons where I'm really disabled. And when your body stops you in your tracks, we often, like, it's normal to get angry, right?
Mm-hmm.
What I learned was, like, my body was wise. There was a fierce kindness in the way that my body stopped me and made me have to put down all of my striving and all of my trying to be loved by what I do and never feeling like I fit in anywhere, running away from my story you know, you probably got angry about your story. I just stuffed it all. I repressed it all. And my body was like, it's still here. it's right here. We're going to make you feel it. And what are you going to do? What I've realized is, like what you described of this acceptance, it's far more easy to accept when there's small ways to like learn how to slow down and actually inhabit the present moment. Which I know you mentioned before we started recording that you are into meditation. See, things like that where we're like learning how to just breathe, mm-hmm. how to be in silence, how to walk mindfully. Like these things they grow our capacity to accept being where we are and to say yes to that invitation.
Yes.
But often our religious communities disciple us into distraction and self-loathing so that our bodies can't even catch up to that being able to say yes, because we live in a sympathetic nervous system state all of the time. And if you're not there, you're probably in shutdown feeling like you're a piece of shit.
Right. So this is a very, you know, our listeners know that I have had a long-standing interest in the Theravada Buddhist writings, you know, because though I don't self-identify as a Buddhist, you know, I would describe myself as a Buddhist enriched Christian. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you read the book because you're a therapist, but the, you know, Scott Peck's old book, The Road Less Traveled. Did you ever read it?
I actually haven't read that. No.
So the opening of the book, I'm just going to read you the opening part of the book, right? It's just the first, this is the lines so famous from it, right? He says, life is difficult, period. This is a great truth. One of the greatest truths. It is a great truth because once we truly see this truth, we transcend it. Once we truly know that life is difficult, once we truly understand and accept it, then life is no longer difficult. Because once it is accepted, the fact that life is difficult no longer matters.
Wow.
And I always thought to myself that that's a very Buddhist idea, right? Life is suffering is what the first of the Four Noble Truths is. And what that literally means is in the translation from the Pali, in the original writing on the of the Buddha, literally means something like life is the feeling of not at homeness. And I love that, right? If we're always perpetually dissatisfied, there's not a human being that is not perpetually dissatisfied with life, right? And the more you argue with that, the more you argue with the idea that life is suffering, life is difficult, the more you suffer.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
that's the irony.
I mean, Thomas Merton says that.
Oh,
almost verbatim. Yeah.
Did she just say Thomas Merton?
Ian, my dog is named Thomas Merton. He's named Merton. But they're right next to me sleeping, actually. I could show you them, but we have two dogs that are
I just fell in love with KJ. You know that. Anthony
Cattell. Merton says that almost exactly.
Well,
like the more that we try to avoid suffering, the more we end up suffering. He said it better, but
yes.
than me.
Right.
Yeah.
And Anthony will do this one maybe after the interview, but he could tell you the story of when I first stood in front of Merton's grave at the Abbey of Gethsemane and I burst into tears because he'd had such a profound influence on my worldview, on my life, on everything, you know?
Yeah.
Okay. Someone comes to you and they say, you're a four, you're schooled in the world of suffering. You are acquainted with grief. Right. And again, this is why, you know, so a seven on the Enneagram comes to you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And they say, all right, so I don't need you to tell me what suffering is. I need you to tell me how to suffer. What would you say?
Yeah, I probably wouldn't tell them. I probably wouldn't tell them much. I would say, how's your body feeling right now?
Okay.
And I would ask them that it is going to be really hard for them, especially for a seven. I think that's at least my experience with my clients who are sevens. Like, what is it like for you to have asked that question to me?
Mm-hmm.
And it's going to get real awkward there, mm-hmm. in that space of silence. But I think I don't like to tell people what to do.
All right, but we're in an elevator and I've got a spear sticking out of my chest and I want you to tell me.
You're not even going to be able to hear me if the spear's sticking out of your chest, Ian.
Well,
you can't
sometimes
hear
that's true
of
people in your room.
You're about to die. No, okay. If you want me to give an actual answer, do you want me to?
From your experience, how that? Okay, so just tell me how to suffer.
Yeah. I would probably say something like, I'm going to borrow someone else's words. I was reading this morning. Joan Chittister said, "Let nothing go by without being open to being nourished by the inner meaning of that event in life."
Right.
Be present to your life.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I talked about the body. What does your body feel right now? Because especially with the seven, but this is so many of us. And it was me before I like learned how to get at home in my body. But any feeling of vulnerability, we want to escape. And it's learning to tolerate that awkwardness or vulnerability, pain, grief, feeling sad, feeling helpless, feeling disconnected, rejected. Like, it's that moment by moment willingness to say, yes, I will be with this.
Yeah.
I don't have to solve it. That's right. How you suffer. That's how you suffer well. And that's actually, it's not really how you suffer. It's just, it's how you live well.
Mm-hmm. You know, I don't think the church is, or the world of faith and its contemporary expression does a very good job of teaching people how to suffer, right? And
why I wrote my book.
Right. Great. Yeah.
Because I was pissed.
Right. Good. Well, you know, a lot of good stuff gets written when you're pissed.
That's right.
Yeah.
You know, I always kind of, where I am now with it is that there's two typical responses to pleasure or pain, which is we either push it away or we cling to it, right? And both, you know, aversion could take the form of, I'm in pain, I'm going to eat a box of, you know, chocolate donuts, or or clinging to it might mean, you know, I'm going to completely identify who I am with this suffering. And pleasure is the same thing, right? We cling to pleasure thinking if we cling to it, it's going to stay forever, right?
Yeah.
And so I've just also learned with suffering, it's like, don't push it away and don't hold on to it.
Right.
If you make space for it, it's going to come and it's going to go. And you just have to learn that it needs to have its way with you. And when it's done, it's done, right?
Yeah.
It's like,
yeah. And to like add a layer to that, like you just read the title of my book, of my first book, is "This Too Shall Last." Like there are things that will stay. Like my complex trauma history will always be part of my story. My disease, unless some crazy miracle happens, it's going to be part of my body for the rest of my life. It's not curable. That's going to stay. But my ability to say, I'm going to be with this and I don't have to freak out.
Mm-hmm.
It won't, this moment will not persist forever.
Mm-hmm.
Both the bad and the good, the like really hard moments and the moments of deep joy. There's then this like, every moment is just dripping with sacredness. There's this, we like to bear witness to that moment. And you only have it, it's fleeting and it's just there for a second, but to let ourselves be there and let it like blow through your hand, like it's a wind that blows through, that's how you remain stable in the middle of it.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, some things stay, but that doesn't mean that we stay in a dark cloud our whole lives.
Mm-hmm. So now you raise another issue that I would have, and I'm personally going to have to do this at some point, which is I've never heard a sermon on the topic of equanimity. I have never heard a sermon on equanimity. If I used that word in church, I would have to define it, which is rather sad. Which is like, okay, so human beings, you know, I guess I could wait until one day someone assigns me the Jesus in the storm text.
There you go. Yeah, but, for that part, lectionary.
Yeah, I have to wait for that part of the lectionary, exactly. So, you know, it seems to me that, and of course, this is the virtue that fours have to work toward, which is how do I remain stable in the face of whatever it is that life throws at me, whether it's a physical ailment or a psychological ailment or, you know, whatever it may be. It's like, how do I just stay stable in the middle of the storm? And it sounds like you just described that that's kind of another sort of step on the journey of suffering well. Someone once asked me, and I had one of my kooky spontaneous answers that turned out to be a good answer without my having thought about it before it came out in my mouth, which is they said, well, okay, tell me what the purpose of parenting is. And I was like, to teach your children how to suffer well.
Love that.
That's good.
That's kind of the big deal, man. Yeah. It's like, teach your kids how to suffer well, you know, and because they're gonna, you know, don't try and protect them from it. That doesn't work. Just teach them how to do it well.
That's right.
You know?
Yep.
So equanimity. Tell me about equanimity, which is the virtue of fours. Like what's your relationship with it?
Well, before I knew that I was a four, I got an anchor tattooed on my wrist where I could see it.
Nice. Nice.
And then when I learned my type, I was like, oh yeah, I knew before I knew. Like this is my life's invitation is to be anchored. And I feel like I have this profound gift in my practice as a therapist it's just the constant practice of equanimity. Like I, especially working from a polyvagal theory, like nervous system regulation standpoint, it's my role and my great responsibility and gift that I get to stay regulated and like become.
Well, what does that mean though? Because you're using a lot of neuroscience terms here, but I'm a little worried that people won't understand.
Thank you. That's very helpful. I forget sometimes that I'm speaking my own, I'm in my own little world, but so moment by moment, for example, in this conversation, like, you know, I told you that story about my mistyping, like you were somebody that I looked up to. So I'm going to come in with a little bit more nerves than I normally would for an interview. My heart's beating a little fast beforehand. So what did I do? I did some deep breathing before we started and I've got my holding cross with me and I'm doing breath prayer like while we're sitting here, because when I notice myself like speeding up too much, like if I feel like I have to prove something, or if I become slightly afraid that, like, what do these people think of me? These kind of thoughts, those are there. But usually I'll notice flushing in my face or tightness in my chest, or my shoulders start to like creep up towards my ears. Those are cues for me that I can take a breath and I can remember that I am safe. I am never going to reject myself. So I can show up as I am. That's what I mean in one sense by regulation. There's so much more.
Yeah.
But yeah, that practice of there are physical things that I can do to remain present, not having to prove anything to anyone, but to bless and honor the sacred in them.
Yes. And I love that what you just did was give an assignment that I don't think anyone we've ever talked about on the show, which is, you know, there's a lot of, when you get into sort of more advanced Enneagram work, there's a whole thing about somatics, right? Like, how do you do work with your body, right?
Yeah.
And I think you just gave fours, but every type, really, a great exercise, which is, you know, how do I remain embodied as I'm doing, as I'm speaking, as I'm doing things, as I'm going through life, right? And paying attention to clues in the body, right? And also that's part of equanimity work, right? It's like,
yeah,
you know, how do I remain emotionally stable and like breathing and being present and all these different things? And that can be done with a little bit of practice. You know, you can do that while in a conversation. You can do that while walking the dog. You could do that while doing your homework. You know, it's like, it's always available to you, right?
So
here's a quote from the Buddha I love that I think really captures what you're saying and also the whole theory about equanimity for fours. It's praise and blame, gain and loss, pleasure and sorrow come and go like the wind. To be happy, rest like a giant tree in the midst of them all. And to me, that is just a great visual illustration of like equanimity, like just stand tall like a tree in the midst of them all, you know, and like don't let this stuff throw you off balance. It's like because it's gonna come, it goes. That's right. Just like be a tree, man. Be a tree.
Okay, also really beautiful. Something I found in researching the book I just finished writing, which I get my edits back out today.
That's a good feeling.
It's a scary feeling, but yeah, for me at least. But okay, something I found was, you know, the biodome in Arizona that they made to like, what would it be like if we made a new biosphere like on Mars someday?
Mm-hmm.
Well, at first the trees, they grew really fast, the trees that they put into this biosphere. But then the trees started to flop over. Like they were dying left and right, even though they were like taller trees than in a normal environment.
Mm-hmm.
And everything they had like done everything they could to replicate Earth's like most pristine, good environment, but they were still dying. And then they realized like the one variable we left out was wind. And when we don't have wind blowing through, a tree can't grow its roots. And I just like so captured by that. Like we have to welcome the wind. There's that, I love that image from that quote, the Buddha, like standing tall and happy, but a tree is still surrounded by weather patterns and they blow through. And to trust that we, like every storm that comes through is only going to sink our roots down deeper.
That's good.
It's a beautiful thing when you start to experience that, or when you look back and you see this last year of chaos, I did become stronger and I did become more capable of like being a welcome place for the birds to land. And you know, like a tree harbors and gives life to other organisms. And but we can't be strong to do that if we don't welcome the wind.
Yummy. That was delicious. I love that picture.
Yeah.
You know, there's another, since we're fours and we're doing pictures, I sometimes tell people who feel like they're saying, you know, I'm falling, man, I'm falling. I go, don't worry, your future self will catch you. And I think that, isn't that yummy too? That's just yummy. I have room to heck knows what I mean, you know, but that's the kind of stuff fours put on Post-its and, you know, put somewhere in the house, you know, just to remind them of like, yummy. You know.
Yes, it's here.
That's how life is.
What did that say?
It's actually on a Post-it, welcome the wind. Like to remind myself.
I mean, seriously, you can't make it up. You know, a lot of types don't do that stuff.
It's just there. Right. Yeah.
You know, I mean, they don't, you know, that's our jam, man. That's the gift that fours bring, you know, in song, in art, in writing, in life, you know. And I think one of the lessons today, you know, in regards to Enneagram is that, you know, I think that in our type, there are tremendous hints about vocation, right? Like when people, Yeah, I think the Enneagram, this is something we should explore sometime, right? It's like the Enneagram invocation. Like how can you look at the superpower of type and ask yourself the question, well, it's a hint. I'm not saying that a two can't be a boxer, right? Like we think, oh, the eight can only be a boxer. No, a two could be a boxer, right? But but it's possible that they're embedded in these types are particular superpowers that could be clues, not determinative, but clues as to what our possible vocation is in life, you know?
Definitely. And,
yeah, it's beautiful. Well, KJ, this has been so awesome. I want to keep going. I
know.
You know what would be really fun about this is we should get off this and just start doing quote wars. Because fours do quotes like nobody's business, you know? We just, especially metaphors and, you know, symbols. Yeah. Like, you know, let's just talk about all the symbols in our house, you know?
Yes.
I just, you'll love this. Since we're talking about trees, Anthony, you're going to love this. But I've recently discovered, because I have a new obsession, which is Japanese bonsai.
Bonsai trees.
You see this? I'm not kidding you, man. It's like, oh, that's a big surprise, right? You can't do that. I'm special.
And, you're so special.
I am so special because I now have a fixation on bonsai trees. And the largest bonsai tree nursery in the country is 3 hours from here.
No way, really?
In Mississippi.
Is it really?
It's in Mississippi. And it's like a giant bonsai tree nursery.
That's crazy.
We can cut this out if we find this is insane. But do you know how much some bonsai trees cost?
I have no clue.
$9,000, $10,000, $12,000.
Oh, really?
And do you know why?
Why?
Well, first of all, some have been sculpted into beautiful art, but many of them are 200, 300, 400, 500 years old.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's just a stunning metaphor to me. And of course, the aesthetic of the bonsai tree is just... After we're done with the show, I'm going to get on the iPad and show you bonsai trees. And I am going to... I've already ordered one, an inexpensive one, to bring home and, you know... and then I'm going to lose my mind and I'm going to build a Zen garden in my backyard.
I love that.
Those are the kind of things that would capture my mind while I was, you know, watching Karate Kid, right? Mm. Or Kung Fu. Do you remember that?
No.
You don't remember Kung Fu?
You mean the movie, the show?
The show.
Oh, yeah. With David Carradine?
Totally.
Oh,
yeah.
Totally. Grasshopper.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, right. 100%.
Yeah. KJ, thanks so much. Your book, This Too Shall Last, is available on Amazon, other places. Your Instagram handle, Facebook, KJ Ramsey. That's with an E, everybody. Ramsey Writes. Writes. KJ Ramsey Writes on Instagram, Facebook. Her website, obviously, kjramsey.com. Some new books coming out. One, you told me earlier, you got two in process. So you are...
June and November.
Wow.
Oh, my gosh.
Not this November, but a year.
This girl's like jamming on advances. I love that.
You know that they're not... They're, no. You know how publishing goes.
I know how publishing goes. We're so delighted you were on. We love talking with fours, and we've loved this conversation. And for those of you who are part of our family or new to our family... Hear these words. May you have love. May you have joy. May you have peace. May you have healing. May you have rest. Until next time.